Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
I actually met my wife on CatholicSingles.com, if you can believe that.
Really?
Yes, I had never done that before. Didn't have any problems with dating.
Natalie and Aaron met on CatholicSingles.com after they realized that they needed to find someone who shared their faith. Meet other faithful Catholics on the original Catholic dating site. Download our app today for free. Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Socks, a Catholic book blogger. And with us today, we have Angel Renier. She is one of the creators of the Catholic Christian Outreach Apostolate. And today we're going to be speaking about a book that has come out of that called Brick by Brick, Building a Strong Family That Won't Lose Their Faith in a Secular Culture. Welcome to the show, Angel.
Thank you. Really happy to be here.
So this was a really good book. A lot of information packed into it. And I guess sort of as a foundation for our discussion today, can you tell us a bit about your organization, Catholic Christian Outreach, and the work that you do?
Okay. It's going to sound like it's not related to the book because what we do is campus evangelization.
Okay.
So we began 30 years ago here in Canada, and we are on campuses across Canada, coast to coast, and in Uganda, and coaching various places around the world in campus ministry and also parishes in how to do evangelization and discipleship. So how on earth did a book like that come out of a movement like this, working with 20-year-olds? Because we've been around for 30 years, both 20-year-olds grew up and started having families. And so because they're friends of ours, they've been in the movement, they asked, you know, how did you guys raise your kids to keep being active and alive in their faith? And so this book came out of that. It came out of so many young families turning to us as, I guess, mentors or at least role models. And we decided we would listen to their plea and write a book on what we did with our kids.
Mm-hmm. So this book is perhaps, you know, I've read other books that have had multiple authors in it. They're more devotional type books, but this book is perhaps one of the most unique that I've ever encountered. It was essentially written by your entire family. How did that process work?
part of doing this book, and I was really reticent to write what we had done because, like, I don't know, like, I don't really know how I did it or what worked well, but we decided to turn to our kids and ask them, what do you think we did that worked well, and what do you think were the mistakes we made? And so we got a lot of great feedback from our children. We have five kids. Three of them are adult children and married. We have four grandchildren. And so during the time that we wrote the book, we happened to all be living in the same city. Mm-hmm. So the process was go to Mass on Sunday, have brunch, and then sit around the living room for 3 hours and talk about the things that were successes, the best practices, and trying to find patterns. Like, what were the what were the key things that, that come together and coalesce and make like principles? And so those are the principles that we have in the chapters of the book. And then we delegated out those chapters, you know, hashing them out and then giving pieces of it to everybody in the family. So everybody says at least something in every chapter of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that was complicated. And it was like doing a massive school group project, but we survived and we're still family.
So we're going to take a look at those chapters in our time today. And one of those things is oftentimes we look at a family as a solo unit and we shy away from outside help or influence. Mm-hmm. But you suggest in the first chapter the opposite. Why is it important for us to make our families part of a village, as you refer to this process as?
Yeah, that's why we put it first and foremost, because I just feel like we can't take too much of the credit. There's so many people in our environment that were influences for the kids. And what the 10 of us noticed is that there were influences at different strata of the village. There's the parish and those families that are there, and even the older folks that are there, and our pastor. The parish was our community, and the kids, I think, felt like they owned the parish hall, you know, like they knew where to get the cookies and they knew all the things. It was their home, and the people there were their community. And then there's another layer that just involves peers, that there's somebody their age that has a similar spirituality, a similar interest in the things of God, that they're not alone. And that's always been a prayer request of ours, and a seeking to try to grow those relationships or put them in places where they'll find them through kids clubs at church or youth groups or, you know, church camps, whatever it takes.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's another layer that we think has, I think those are obvious. I think they're in every family, but the part that maybe is unique that we were able to tap into is finding role models that are just slightly older than the peer level. So that means if a child is 15, that you have role models in the family life that are 20. Or if your child is 6, that there's role models that are 12. So there's just a slightly higher age group that the children, whatever age they are, can be like, wow, like I want to aspire to be like that when I get a little bit older. They're cool, they're this, they're that. And those are the things that we feel have really helped our kids. Because we're in campus ministry, we just have 20-year-olds in our house on a regular basis. And they're not doing anything particularly catechetical with our kids. But it's who they are, how they live their lives, how they act, how they talk about their faith,
mm-hmm.
that has a powerful aroma for the kids to want to run after. And so we suggest some alternatives for those that don't have the privilege of doing campus ministry. Like, where do you find these magical 20-year-olds?
Right.
They're out there, and you want to find them and make them steak and cake and whatever it takes to make them to want to come to your house and play with your kids.
Mm-hmm. It's essentially the example of witness that the early Christians did as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We need those witnesses. People that we can imagine our life being like.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good.
Right, right. You know, I think one of the hardest challenges we face today, and it you talk about it in the second chapter of the book, is to be in the world but not necessarily deeply entrenched or part of it. How do we strike this delicate balance between not totally isolating ourselves from the world, but mm-hmm. then again, making sure we're in it to some degree?
Yeah. It's really tricky, and it's maybe a bit of an art. It's understanding that it's a balance. And I talk about in the chapter how really our home life was in some ways protected. The people that came into our home were good Catholic practicing disciples of Jesus. You know, generally the people that were in our lives were doing and feeling the same way about faith as we were. But this idea of being in the world is not hard to do, because the extracurricular, like sports, club, school, your actual neighborhood, cousins. Those sorts of people are everywhere, and they're not hard to find. So that's where the mission ground is. And I guess the reason why we emphasize being in the world but not of the world is that we really think it's important for to have a higher goal for your children in their adult life than I hope they go to mass when they grow up. Mm-hmm. The desire that we had for our kids was that they would be active missionary disciples. That was the mentality that we had in raising them. So in their community, in the world that was around us, we wanted to help them see that these are people who just need to know the love of God. These are people who just haven't experienced the Lord yet. These are people who need a conversion of life and just don't know it yet. And we try to instill in the kids to not be afraid of the world, but to see it through almost the Father's eyes. How does God the Father see the folks in the world? And yeah, there's sin and there's nonsense and there's dangerous things. Absolutely. That's all part of protecting and forming your kids to make good decisions. But amongst all of that are the souls of human beings who were made in the image and likeness of God, who were made to know Him. And so how can I grow that sort of compassionate care in my children for the salvation and well-being of others, and not to see people as enemies or threats? Mm-hmm. Certainly see sin as a threat, but not to see people as a threat, and how to at least have compassion, secondly, to pray for them, and third, to possibly be a witness to them. So those are the types of things we try to talk about in that chapter.
Mm-hmm.
It is a bit of a dance.
Yeah, and I want to stay with that one just a little bit more, because I think it's kind of a pressing issue to Catholics today. We want Christ in our lives, but society does all it can to try and tell us how old-fashioned that is and flawed of a thinking that is. How can we successfully deal with this and again, you know, still be part of everyday life? Because there is a tendency to want to just, especially with all the craziness going on in the world today, just shut it all out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one thing is to know that every single human being on this earth was made to be in relationship with God and was made to receive His mercy. And it's just, you know, a prayer away from being a brother or sister in Christ.
Hmm.
And so that sort of a mentality is really important even as adults to have about the world. We can't be afraid of the world. We can't be afraid of the people. We have to be living in a place of confidence in our sonship and daughtership with the Lord, and with a concern, a solitary concern for others, that they would be saved, that they could know the God who has created them. This is the foundation of the adult life. If the adult is not afraid of the world, is not retreating. By retreating, meaning retreating from people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the pressure around us, even as adults, to take from the world what is good, because all created things, all of God's creatures, creatures meaning created things that St. Ignatius of Loyola teaches us, can be used for God's greater glory. We have to be indifferent to them, but they're not to be shunned necessarily. So with great discernment and with a holy disposition, the things of this world can be very beautiful, can be great reflections that we can use to turn towards spiritual conversations, like the latest Star Wars movie has so many spiritual themes through it. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It just allows for a really good, relevant conversation with people that can turn towards spiritual things. So there's this discernment and confidence and lack of fear, but discernment. That same dance has to be in our lives as we are in the world, and not to feel threatened. And I think that's the part that catches touches all of us. And we feel very threatened by what's happening in the world. And we just have to be able to stand with a certain confidence, even in explaining what's wrong with the world, you know, what's wrong with certain ideologies or perspectives. But yeah, this isn't the way God intended for man to live. This isn't God's plan. This is how God planned for us to live in freedom. And it has to be just said with, I don't know if you're catching the tone I'm trying to use, but there's a lightness and confidence that isn't wrapped up in anger and fear at the world.
Gotcha.
And it's just that slight difference of tone that I think really can have a lasting effect on kids, for the negative or for the good.
In the third chapter, you look at decision making, and that one's a big one. When it comes to passing that trait on to our children, what have you found to be key in making sure they're prepared to make the tough decisions that they're going to have to make in life as well?
In the simplest terms, it would be teaching your children WWJD. You know, the little bracelets everybody had in the 2000s. What would Jesus do? That's kind of what it is. But I would say, like, my first response to a question like that would be, begin when they're a toddler. Because the kind of discipline that is given to a child to know right from wrong, to know what is allowed and what isn't, to know the boundaries, and to be able to be then further asked as they're getting a little older, what do you think is the right thing to do? What do you think you should do? What do you think God wants you to do? It's going to help a child, actually, when they're 18, think about what is the right thing for me to do. What is the right way to respect myself, my friends, my parents, God, in the decision that I make? And that actually starts with the most simplest of things with toddlers. And I gained a lot of this from the readings of, the author, I forget his first name, but Stinson. And he talks about raising children, and he has just really good insights on it. And he just talks about how children that he's seen in his years as an educator that lacked that kind of consistency and responsibleness in the way they were parented, in the way that they were disciplined as children, affected how they grew up as adults. And I've also seen that.
We're going to take a quick break. There's plenty more to discuss about Brick by Brick. We're going to be back with Angèle. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media.
Teachings for an Unbelievable World is a newly discovered work written by St. John Paul II, then Archbishop Karol Wojtyła of Krakow, in the years just after Vatican II. This is the first English language publication of this important work. In this hardcover book that Scott Hahn calls one of the greatest hidden treasures unearthed in our time, 13 brief homilies provide compelling teaching for Catholics in today's post-Christian world and give fresh insights into JP2's pontificate. You can get a copy of this important new book at AveMariaPress.com. Use code JP2Teachings, that's JPIIteachings, to get 20% off your copy today.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. We're spending it today with Angèle Regnier discussing her book, Brick by Brick, Building a Strong Family That Won't Lose Their Faith in a Secular Culture. And Angèle, as we've worked our way through the books, you touched upon discipline at the close of the last segment. That, I think, is a parent's one of the hardest things to tackle, the when, how, and why. Obviously, kids don't come with an instruction manual. And you talk about a lot in depth in the fourth chapter about the three aspects of consistent, timely, and reasonable being those three aspects for discipline. Can you outline that a bit for us and give us some tips on how best to tackle that topic?
Yeah. What I was trying to communicate there with the three aspects is that being consistent is probably the hardest of them all. And it's when we kind of can get into a, we're the general and we've got all the things and we're barking the orders at the kids and we're super organized. And then maybe there's another day where we're tired, lazy, whatever, and we just turn a blind eye. And then another time we're really casual with what kids can do, and another time we freak out because what are you guys doing this thing that they were allowed to do 3 weeks earlier? So that kind of inconsistency just really confuses kids. It's so bad for them, and it's so bad for you. It just puts parents in a really, whatever. It just creates, like, so much anger in the family because the kids don't understand the rules of the game. They don't understand what's going on. We thought we could. We thought we couldn't. Maybe I can get away with it. Why are they mad at me that I can't get away with it this time? And I've observed this in kids over and over again, and I just think biggest favor that parents can do for themselves is to get up and consistently deal with what was the rule on the simplest of things at the youngest of ages. And not in a harsh way at all, but just in a confident consistency so that kids understand how things work. And the kinds of meltdowns that can happen with children really, I think, largely can be avoided if they understand the background, they understand what's going on, they understand the rules, the framework, and they understand what's going to happen to them if they don't do what they need to do. So I know that's, like, probably, like, not rocket science to be consistent, but guess what? That is, when push comes to shove, that's where parents drop the ball, mm-hmm. is being consistent and getting up off the chair, getting at eye length, getting eye to eye with a child and speaking to them about why they can't do what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge.
Yeah.
We often... the timely part is, I have timely and mm-hmm. I'm trying to find it in the book myself. I'm not sure what page we're on, but timely and reasonable is that basically mistakes that I've made is when I'm trying to, like, when you get home, you know, this is going to happen, or when your father gets home. And by that time, everybody's forgotten about it. The kids don't understand the consequence. Like, everything was fine for the last 3 hours, but now I'm getting punished. It really has to be timely. It has to be a teachable moment. And the other one is being reasonable. What's a reasonable punishment for a child of this age for whatever they did? And you don't want to over punish and you don't want to under punish. And kids can tell if things are in right order or not, and if it's consistent from one kid to another over the years. And they will remind you of the things that you did in the past. But this all helps kids to get the framework in their head, and children are wired to know what their boundaries are. And so if we just can keep to those principles, actually, like I said, you save yourself and your child a lot of grief.
Mm. And we often talk about kind of... piggybacked off that, we often talk about children respecting their parents, but the opposite needs to be adhered to as well, and that is parents need to respect their children. So mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that in striking that balance?
Yeah, we talked about this quite a bit, especially with my daughter, who's the main author of the book. She herself is a mother. And just the heartbreak that we've witnessed of watching, being in conversation with other moms who are talking about their child and the problems they're having parenting them or their behavior. But the child is in the room. The child can hear the mother or father complaining about their child. And you can just almost feel their little heart taking on the conversation. Either, and we don't know. We know that the kids can hear it. But what's the absorption happening? What's the concept of their own self that they're having while their mother is, or father is complaining about them? And I can only imagine it's either reinforcing, I'm a bad child, and I guess that's who I am, that's how I get talked about, or maybe it's reinforcing shame, or maybe it's reinforcing them to have disrespect to their parents because the parent is disrespecting them in public. Yeah, so there's just lots of ways that parents can disrespect children. And it can even be when we get so impatient and we start, you know, losing it, like getting starting, the voice starts to rise, and we're starting to yell, and we're getting impatient, and we're, you know, pushing little bodies along, like, let's go. That kind of, like, elevation of our impatience can break down, in really bad ways. But I kind of have to, I've stopped myself in the past, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, like, who's the adult in the room here? It has to be me. I have to be the adult. Like, I can't come to the level of my child and how they're acting. I have to act like the 30 or 40 year old here. So if I don't act like an adult, I'm going to act like a child, and I am going to breed disrespect within the relationship, because children know you're not acting like an adult should. And so this is not a respectful way to raise children, and not being respectable of yourself, not being respectable as an adult. So those are some insights that we had talking about it together as a family.
Mm-hmm. You know, one chapter that I really sort of got a lot out of was the one where you talk about commitments and responsibilities. And our lives are filled with, you know, various levels of those. And you look at that in the home life chapter. How can we effectively strike the balance between all these things we have on our list? Work, home, volunteering, extended family, friends. I mean, the list could go on and on.
Yeah. Yeah, the list can really go on and on. And I don't want it to sound like preachy or dictating how people would do it, but I can just share like what goes on in my mind mm-hmm. when I consider the things that are coming at our family, the events, the programs, the commitment. And what's going on in my mind and for Andre and I is, okay, so what toll does this take on the family? How will this affect family life, our family dinner, our weekend, the kids' desire to do such and such a thing, basically family events, you know? And so a lot of our decisions are like, we don't need to do this. And most of those decisions have been made for us in terms of the kids' extracurricular activities. And I just see, it's my particular thing, I just really am concerned about the toll that kid programs have on the home, on the family. And so when family meals are actually generally rushed or usurped because we're chauffeuring kids to sports, dance, drama, whatever it is, and if you have multiple kids with multiple events, then family life can become kind of utilitarian, that we're getting some sort of meal out in the car as we drive off, as we do all these things. And I just didn't want to live our family life like that. I didn't think it was worth the toll that it took on our relationships as a family and on the growth of my children, which I think I based more on their character and on their ability to be family and to be a community than on their ability to do figure skating. Now, some kids will have, you know, real desires and real talent at something, and that's what you have to weigh and measure. For our kids, they had certain activities, certain things that they were into, certain things that they weren't. And if they weren't really that into it, and it was just kind of like busyness or sick of busyness, like I just said, let's opt out. Like, why do we need to do this? So I think that's largely my personality coming through. I don't like change. I like consistency. I'm kind of the homebody person.
Mm-hmm.
My husband would be more outgoing and be more athletic and would enjoy going out to do a bunch of different sporting events. But we chose to strike a balance with our kids and what they were into, what was good for the family, and then what was reasonable for us to actually carry out, because sometimes people travel so much, like my husband, that actually even if we signed our kids up for all the things they wanted to, there's no human way we could get them everywhere they want to be. So that was part of what we had to do with our choices, was also the work demand.
Right. one of the things you talk about a lot in the closing chapters of the book is the spiritual life. You commit a good chunk of time to that. What are some ways we can cultivate a personal prayer life in our children? Because, you know, as they age, that prayer life is going to change and become more complex. So how do we boil down a prayer life to a child's view, I guess is what I'm trying to get at.
Mm-hmm. I think everybody kind of knows how to pray with a little child, tucking them into bed with nighttime stories, say some prayers, God bless grandma, God bless, you know, mm-hmm. like those kinds of innocent, sweet prayers I don't think are a big mystery. But I think there's a sort of, there's a change that happens when kids stop having bedtime stories. They start going to bed on their own. And now how do I help a child to pray? And I mean, I don't have like an outline for how to, you know, walk your way through this, but there is something about encouraging a child to just talk to Jesus as a friend and to bring the things they're concerned about. So the things that get shared after school or around the dinner table, things that are bothering them, is to be able to say to them, like, you know, why don't you just say a little prayer tonight when you're going to bed and tell Jesus what you're thinking about this, what's bothering you about it. Mm-hmm. And then following up with them the next day to just say, like, did you get a chance to talk to Jesus about it? Did you get any sense of what he might be saying to you? And that's probably not what most people do with their kids. And we would actually ask our kids something like that, you know, occasionally, not every day, certainly, but in different moments of their lives where they're going through something, we would say to them, like, go to your bedroom, talk to the Lord, be quiet, open your Bible, and just see if he has something to say to you. In simplicity, not overcomplicating it on how they should do it. And it's remarkable how many times our kids came back and said, like, well, I just felt like God was maybe saying, and it would be just perfect. It was like, okay, wow, that's awesome. And that gives them a confidence for children that actually the Holy Spirit is real. Like, he will inspire me with good holy thoughts, with ideas, with a solution, with a calm or a confidence. And then as kids get older, we kind of would take more concrete ways of showing them how to sit and open their Bible and pray, or do Ignatian type of prayer of imagining a scene and placing themselves there. What do you think Jesus is doing in the Garden of Gethsemane right now? And what do you imagine is happening? And just all those kinds of environments. And then as the kids got older, I would say like in their teen years is when we would have encouraged morning personal prayer, to get into a habit of even 15 minutes of reading the readings of the day, journaling about what struck them about it or what's on their heart or what they're concerned about, and to give the Lord their day. Something very simple, maybe having them listen to worship music in the morning or going to bed. And these are just ways of fostering in their own inner life, ways of communicating in a very conversational and personal way with God. Besides all the things that they're going to learn about sacramental life and going to confession and praying the rosary as a family. You know, like all those things are out there, but the piece that we want to emphasize in the spiritual life was the dynamic of actually encountering the Lord in a personal, ongoing, moment-by-moment, real, relational way.
Mm-hmm. So one last question. How do you get them? So we looked at that kind of as an individual thing. What do we do to nurture a family, you know, to bring them into the fold of the family prayer? What did you find that was successful for you?
To make the family feel like a family?
No, to have a joint prayer together, like, you know, the rosary and stuff like that. What was ways mm-hmm. you made that happen?
Okay. So the ways that we made that happen are maybe not as typical as you would expect. And there's a bit of a reason for that, because we do ministry and we have people over talking spiritual things all the time. We had to kind of maybe do something that is counterintuitive, and that was to not overdo the devotions and piety as a family. Mm. And that's because we've just observed in a similar context, let's say Protestant brothers and sisters that are pastors, and there's a little bit of a thing that can happen with, they call them PKs, pastor's kids, preacher's kids, mm-hmm. where they can get really bitter for their parent being so involved in ministry. And so I was sensitive to that because we were full-time lay missionaries, that I didn't want to put our kids in a place where they felt trapped by our lives of faith. So our expressions of family prayer were more centered around either the seasons of like Lent or Advent, doing a special effort during those seasons to do family prayer, to do family rosary, or when we would go and do pilgrimage or go on a big trip, then we'd do a family rosary in the car, or praying for specific needs that are coming up, like if someone is sick or there's a concern or there's a problem at school, that we might just stop as a family and pray together. So we did things that were maybe more on the side of a teachable moment or special circumstances, because of the environment in which we're in, that we're always in spiritual mode. So I'm not sure if that method works the best for every family, but it's what worked for us. Mm-hmm. And I guess the advantage of that was that we definitely didn't put to our kids, from a devotional or piety perspective, the expectations that some adults can't live out. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that sometimes as parents that are, like, let's say I'm really into the Novena of Grace leading up to Francis Xavier's feast day, and I love it, and it's one of my favorite things. And sometimes as a parent, I could want to get my kids to have to do all the things that I love to do from a spiritual practice point of view. But my kids don't necessarily love it, and they don't necessarily want to take the time to do that. And even some adults don't want to do it. So I can invite, but I don't have to expect. And sometimes that expecting for family prayer can get really tense and backfire. And I was very sensitive to not do that, like I said, because of mm-hmm. our career as missionaries.
Well, Andrea, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your day and spending with us. Where can people find your book, Brick by Brick?
So we're being sold with Sophia Institute Press, and so you can find it there. And if they're in Canada, we're on our website, cco.ca, and there's a store on our website for our apocalypse.
Well, again, thanks for spending time with us today. Any closing thoughts?
I just want to encourage families to not be afraid, to not be afraid of all that the world is and all the craziness, and to just try to live in the joy of the Lord and to bring your children into the joy of the Lord and his desire to be known and his desire to be known by others. And so if we have a mindset that is with this great vision in mind, and that our children will be missionary disciples as they grow up, and I'm going to give them teachable moments to live it out as children, you'll find that they'll be happily willing to follow our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ.
Fantastic. And with that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And until next time, God bless.
Teachings for an Unbelievable World is a newly discovered work written by St. John Paul II, then Archbishop Karol Wojtyla of Krakow, in the years just after Vatican II. This is the first English language publication of this important work. In this hardcover book that Scott Hahn calls one of the greatest hidden treasures unearthed in our time, 13 brief homilies provide compelling teaching for Catholics in today's post-Christian world and give fresh insights into JP2's pontificate. You can get a copy of this important new book at AveMariaPress.com. Use code JP2Teachings, that's JPII Teachings, to get 20% off your copy today. Looking for exceptional coffee delivered fresh to your door? We have the answer. Our friends at Grim Bean Coffee produce small batch artisan coffee using top-tier coffee beans. The coffee is roasted when you order, guaranteeing the freshest coffee possible. Check out Breadbox Roasts, a new line of Catholic-themed coffees available at www.grimbeancoffee.com/breadboxmedia. Experience coffee like never before.